individual regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Variant Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be taking a look at what's going on in state legislatures around the country, including in Virginia. We're also going to be talking, I should mention, with Knox Williams from the American Suppressor Association on tomorrow's program. Knox is going to be in Richmond today for a hearing over on the House side of the General Assembly, where they are taking up in committee both the 11% excise tax on the sale of firearms and ammunition and the $500 tax on the sale of all suppressors in Virginia. Both of those tax increases would come into effect July 1st of this year. The Senate, I believe, has already passed the 11% excise tax on the sale of firearms and ammunition. And it's ridiculous. You know, the sponsor of this legislation says, well, customers aren't going to pay this. This is an excise tax. This is going to be paid by the manufacturer. Right. Yeah. No, they'll eat that cost, right? They will pass it on to the distributor, who will in turn pass that cost on to the retailer, who will in turn pass that cost on to the customer. That's how it works. We know this is how it works, but the Democrats are insisting, oh, no, you gun owners in Virginia, you're not going to feel the pinch. Yeah. Yeah, you are, unfortunately. And, you know, as this bill progresses, we'll probably talk about the potential for litigation and one of the hurdles to litigation, which is the Pittman-Robertson Act. We've talked about that fund before. This is an 11% federal excise tax on the sale of firearms and ammunition. And it is what anti-gunners are using to try to jack up the cost of exercising our segment rights even more. That's their excuse, right? Well, if we can fund wildlife efforts through this excise tax at the federal level, why can't we fund anti-gun violence efforts at the state level with the same amount of tax? The sad thing is, it's not a terrible argument. Although, you know, there's a big difference between Pittman-Robertson funds and what those are spent on and what the Democrats in Virginia are hoping to do with this tax revenue from the 11% excise tax on guns and ammunition. So anyway, we're going to be talking a lot about Virginia tomorrow. I do want to talk a little bit about Virginia today, though, before we get into some of the legislative items from around the country. The Virginia Citizens Defense League sent out an alert yesterday, and it certainly does look like the Second Amendment Sanctuary movement is maybe Second Amendment Sanctuary 2.0 is picking up steam around the state. I'm glad to see this. It is not getting nearly the same attention that it got in, you know, late 2019, early 2020, when Democrats took control of the state legislature. And then Governor Ralph Northam said, yeah, we're going to pass a gun ban. That's our first thing. In fact, you existing owners, you're going to have to turn them in. Even though the onslaught of Second Amendment, onslaught of gun control bills is arguably much worse than what it was 6 years ago. We're not necessarily seeing, you know, thousands of people or even hundreds of people show up at these county supervisors meetings, but we are seeing, I think, a core group of Second Amendment supporters who are getting in front of their supervisors and saying, listen, you need to take a stand here. And these county level officials are listening. So Westmoreland County last night had a vote to affirm the county's Second Amendment sanctuary status at their regular meeting. I believe that a vote passed. Colonial Heights, which is a suburb of Richmond, Virginia, the Colonial Heights City Council will be reading their 2019 sanctuary resolution at the city council meeting tomorrow night, or tonight rather. Again, this is one of the many localities of Virginia that passed a resolution in 2019. This reading tonight would be to reaffirm the city's status as a Second Amendment sanctuary. Prince George County, also slated to vote on a 2A sanctuary resolution tonight. I believe St. George, Prince George County was one of those that adopted a Second Amendment sanctuary resolution roughly 6 years ago, but hopefully they will do it again this evening. Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors, they've got a reaffirmation of their Second Amendment sanctuary status coming up February 18th. Fluvanna County is actually one of those counties I went to in person when the Board of Supervisors was meeting 6 years ago. And, you know, Fluvanna County is a pretty rural county. County Courthouse is actually a really beautiful structure. It's located next to the Old Stone Jail, which I believe might be the oldest jail in Virginia. Anyway, I couldn't find a place to park because, again, there were hundreds of people who had turned out in support of this resolution. I hope that the numbers are that strong coming up next week. Wythe County in Southwest Virginia, Stacey Terry, the Wythe County Supervisor at Large, reporting to VCDL that the Wythe County Board of Supervisors has reaffirmed the county's 2A sanctuary status. In fact, they did so about a month ago, January 13th, by a unanimous 7-0 vote. Campbell County Board of Supervisors also voting unanimously to reaffirm the county's Second Amendment sanctuary status on February the 3rd. And the Spotsylvania County Board of Supervisors reiterating that the county is still a 2A sanctuary at their January 29th meeting. So, again, we are seeing progress here. We've got a number of localities coming up with votes this week. If you live in Virginia, you have not heard me mention your county. Again, I'd encourage you to contact your Board of Supervisors, contact your particular supervisor, contact your county sheriff, contact your Commonwealth's attorney, and urge them again to make these public statements. If your Board of Supervisors, again, reaffirm or pass a Second Amendment sanctuary resolution, county sheriffs, Commonwealth's attorneys, I would love to see more of them on the record saying, listen, I'm not going to use my office to go out and harass peaceable gun owners and charge them with a nonviolent possessory offense, no matter what the General Assembly has to say. But we will keep our eyes on what's going on again in Virginia, not just because it's where I live, but again, because it is ground zero for the anti-gunners this year as they try to turn a state with pretty good gun laws into South Jersey, East California, whatever you want to call it. I'm going to try to flip that switch overnight and align Virginia with some of the most anti-gun regimes in the country. Speaking of anti-gun regimes, New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has been trying for years to get a gun ban bill to her desk. And this year, unfortunately, I got to say, she's making some progress. SB 17 has passed out of the Senate. This is a bill that would not only ban the sale of every gas-operated semi-automatic centerfire rifle, those with fixed magazines with a capacity more than 10 rounds, and then all those that accept detachable magazines. It would also impose new restrictions on FFLs in the state of New Mexico. I saw a column from a New Mexico gun dealer yesterday talking about the double whammy here, right? So not only are these gun stores going to be hit with expensive new security mandates, but they're not going to be able to sell, you know, and in some cases, a majority of the products that are on their shelves, they won't be able to sell large capacity magazines, quote unquote, anything again that can hold more than 10 rounds, won't be able to sell virtually any semi-automatic rifle that's on the market today, restrictions on semi-automatic shotguns, you know, some AR style pistols would fall under this definition as well. So these FFLs are going to be in a world of hurt. And this gun dealer says he doesn't know how many of them are going to be able to survive. He says, yeah, that's going to be challenged in court, and they believe that it'll be successful. But in the meantime, you got to pay the bills, right? And these court cases can drag on for years. So SB 17's passed out of the House. It is scheduled for its first committee hearing in the House, on Wednesday, in the House Commerce and Economic Development Committee. This is going to take place tomorrow, Wednesday, 1:30 p.m. Mountain Time. You can contact your elected officials. You may be able to submit testimony. Although I got to say, I mean, I've watched some of these committee hearings, and they are just blowing right by a lot of folks who do want to testify in opposition to these bills. So that's what's going on in New Mexico. Louisiana, I wrote about this earlier today, campus carry legislation introduced. The session doesn't begin for about another month, but this is House Bill 99 introduced by Representative Danny McCormick. He was one of the architects of permitless carry. This is a mostly good bill. There's one phrase in there that I think needs clarification. There's a carve-out for private facilities and classrooms located on these, you know, college and university campuses. Now, I don't know if that means private classrooms in these private facilities or if that just means classrooms entirely. That'd be a big difference, right? If you are trying to exempt all classroom settings, then obviously that's going to gut a campus carry. If this is related to, you know, let's say, you know, daycare facilities, classrooms and daycare facilities on campuses, that's something else entirely. That's a much more limited carve out. As written, House Bill 99 actually applies to not just public colleges and universities in the state, but any institution of higher learning that receives public funds. So this would apply to private universities as well. And generally speaking, outside of that one kind of wonky provision where we do need some clarification, this bill is really strong. There are only a couple of, you know, gun-free zones on these campuses, administrative disciplinary hearings, mental health facilities that are on campus, I think are the two biggies that I have seen. Don't know that, you know, we're going to see progress. This is not the first time around that Representative McCormick has introduced campus carry. But hopefully this will be the year that they get across the finish line. The New Hampshire House has already approved a campus carry bill this session. That's over on the Senate side. And, you know, the anti-gunners are making a lot of moves. This is a very robust year for gun control legislation at the state level. And it's kind of difficult to match them on the pro-gun side of things. We already have 29 states that are permitless carry. The only state that's kind of even within reaching distance of that right now is North Carolina. And the problem is Republicans no longer have a veto-proof majority in the House, and they've got a governor who will veto permitless carry. So, you know, the prospects of red states passing big, bold initiatives, most of them already have. Meanwhile, you know, the gun control advocates can get really creative in terms of infringing on our right to keep and bear arms, right? So whether it's a permit to purchase law, whether it is, you know, the two states that are in a position now to pass bans on commonly owned magazines and semi-automatic firearms, you can always expand a red flag law to, you know, allow more people to petition the courts to have somebody's firearms removed. You can impose weighting limits. I mean, they have a lot more room to work with in terms of restricting our right to keep and bear arms than a lot of red states do in terms of enhancing or strengthening our right to keep and bear arms. But campus carry, I'd say, is one of those areas where red states can act. At the moment, I believe there are 11 states with campus carry laws. And there are states, you know, with Republican supermajorities that don't have those laws in place. Oklahoma, for one. Florida is another. Now, Florida, again, we've talked about the problem with the state Senate and Senate President Ben Albright. I believe she's the head of the Justice Committee, Kathleen Passidomo, former state Senate president, neither one of whom are really interested in repealing any of the post-Parkland gun laws or passing something like campus carry. So that's a challenge. In Oklahoma, the state regents have been very opposed to a campus carry. And it's been tough to get buy-in, honestly, from a lot of Republican lawmakers, I think, as a result of that. Chamber of Commerce, I think, has also come out against a campus carry. So you've got, you know, some real challenges, I think, even in red states, in terms of moving the needle in the right direction. But, you know, again, just given the voracious appetite for infringing on our right to keep our arms that we're seeing in blue states across the country this year, it really is incumbent on Republicans, wherever possible, to move the needle towards full recognition of our right to keep and bear arms. So again, we'll be talking more about what's going on in Virginia tomorrow. Thursday, we're going to be zeroing in on Colorado. There are a number of gun control bills that have already been introduced. There were rumors of more legislation targeting gun owners that was supposed to be introduced yesterday. This was kind of billed as legislation in response to the shooting at Evergreen High School there in Colorado. It turns out that they did not introduce a gun control bill. Instead, they introduced a legislation at both the state and federal level that would require social media companies to basically be more proactive and quicker about turning information over to law enforcement when there are, you know, threats made or you know, somebody posting concerning details. Even though gun control isn't a part of that legislation, unfortunately, there are, as I said, a number of other bills in Colorado that would impact your right to keep and bear arms. So we'll be talking with Laura Carno about those bills coming up on Thursday. Right now, though, let's get to our armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Oh, actually, there's one more state that I wanted to mention before we move on to those things. In Wyoming, the legislative session is underway. There are bills that would further expand the right to carry that have been introduced. There's also another bill I wrote about for bearing arms a couple of days ago that I think is really interesting. I don't know if it's going to get legs. This is supposedly a budget session in Wyoming, so it's tougher to actually introduce bills. I think you've got to have like 2/3 majority to bring a bill to the floor during a budget session. One bill, though, that is being shopped around and already has, I think, like 26 co-sponsors in the House, is a bill that would, let's say you act in self-defense, but you are arrested, you are charged with a crime. If the individual lives, you know, maybe it's, aggravated assault, attempted murder, the assailant who you were defending yourself against or maybe defending others against, they pass away, maybe you're facing a murder charge. If those charges are dropped, or if you are acquitted of those charges because you acted in self-defense, this bill would basically say you get your attorney's fees paid for. You should not suffer financially, in other words, because you acted in self-defense. That, to me, seems like a very reasonable, common-sense bill. I don't know that it's going to get a lot of traction in Wyoming this year. I hope that it does. Again, the barriers to entry, I think, are a little bit higher this session. But that's one bill that we are keeping our eye on. And hopefully, again, we'll see some progress. Okay. Now, before we get to our good deed of the day, our armed citizen story, and our recidivist report, we should also talk about this for a second. From city streets to mountain trails, your gear should go wherever life takes you. And that's why at Modern Rugged Leather, every bag is handcrafted from premium, responsibly sourced leather. It's designed to look sharp, last long, tell a story of its own. Every stitch, every buckle, every strap reflecting timeless craftsmanship. It's backed by a lifetime warranty because quality shouldn't quit when the adventure begins. So whether it's the boardroom or the back roads, Modern Rugged Leather helps you carry confidence every step of the way. Modern Rugged Leather. Modern style, timeless durability, backed for life. Life takes you places. Make sure your gear keeps up. Shop the full collection and find yours today, because you can't have mine, at modernrugged.com. Again, that's modernrugged.com. You can find one that looks like mine, but you can't have mine. I'm not giving it up. All right, on to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Louisville, Kentucky, where the local Republicans are blasting a judge who slashed a jury's sentence in half for an individual convicted of a violent crime, a very violent crime. Christopher Earl Thompson, was accused of forcing his way into a woman's car in July 2023, sexually assaulting her twice, forcing her to drive to an ATM and withdraw money. At the time of this incident, Thompson was, I believe, 21 years old. He was already on probation, and he was enrolled in a diversion program after possessing a stolen firearm and fleeing from officers. So this case goes to trial in December. Last 4 days, the jury ultimately finds Thompson guilty, and they recommended 65 years in prison for this violent crime. Instead, Circuit Court Judge Tracy Davis says, no, I'm not going to follow the jury's recommendation. Instead, I'm going to sentence Christopher Earl Thompson to 30 years behind bars, which, you know, again, given time off for good behavior behind bars, that 30-year sentence is not going to be 30 years. We're looking at closer to 15 years, which means that the 23-year-old Thompson is likely to be out and back on the streets before he turns 40. During the sentencing hearing, the judge said that she believed the jury's recommended sentence was excessive and left no chance for Thompson's rehabilitation. She said, quote, unfortunately, he fell through the cracks and ended up before this court as an 18 or 19-year-old. This court does not believe that Mr. Thompson, if given the resources that he can get while incarcerated, is beyond being rehabilitated. Clay Kennedy, who was Thompson's trial attorney, said in 13 years of practice, he's never had a judge disregard a jury's recommendation. Obviously, he doesn't have a problem with it. He talked about his client's difficult upbringing. According to the Courier-Journal, declined to discuss specific trauma or abuse he may have experienced, but said that Thompson's pre-sentence investigation was among the saddest that he has read in his career. Conservatives in Louisville say that doesn't matter, as sad as it might be. Here's an individual who, again, committed a very violent assault. Minority Caucus Chair Anthony Piacentini told the Courier-Journal that judges should trust jury sentencing decisions, that Davis's ruling disrespected the jury process. He said, where's the concern for the victim? Do we think she's going to get over this in 30 years? Where's the concern for the safety of the public when he does get released from jail? Where's the concern for the respect for the jury process? He also said he doesn't believe that Thompson can be rehabilitated. Called him a disgusting, evil sociopath who should, quote, never again breathe free air. Saying that he showed zero remorse. Pointing to court records showing that Thompson made denigrating remarks to the judge and the female prosecutor handling the case, both during and after the trial. Thompson told the prosecutor he would see her in 20 years, called her a bitch, told Davis to eat his dick multiple times during sentencing, said, if I could spit on you, I would. Told the judge. Also repeatedly interrupted Davis as she explained her reasoning for imposing a lower sentencing. She actually found him in contempt of court, even while reducing his sentence, and added a little more than 4.5 years to his sentence. Now, prosecutors had offered Thompson an 18-year plea deal. They say in order to spare the victim from testifying at trial. But I guess he declined that plea deal. The case goes to trial. She did show up to testify. And again, this 65-year sentence that was recommended by the jury slashed by more than half to 30 years. And again, he's not going to serve 30 years behind bars. So, you know, is that an appropriate sentence? I don't think so. According to, and I was wrong, by the way, he'll be eligible for parole after serving 20 years, according to court officials. So I figured it was going to be closer to 15, but 20 years. And being eligible for parole doesn't mean that he'll get parole. Doesn't mean he won't either. You know, this wasn't probation, right? 20 years is still a pretty lengthy amount of time. But it is not what the jury recommended. It is far less than what the jury recommended. After hearing what Thompson did to this victim, after seeing his outbursts in court, after seeing his contempt for the judge, for the prosecutor, for everybody involved in this process, and I gotta tell you, I think I side with the Republicans here. I don't understand why the judge would have done this. Does he turn his life around? Is there a chance that he is able to rehabilitate himself behind bars? Maybe. Maybe. But does that mean that he deserves another chance at freedom after just 2 decades? I'm not convinced. You know, there are individuals who turn their life around while they're in prison who serve a life without parole sentence. They still manage to better themselves behind bars. They're not looking at freedom as the outcome. They're looking at becoming a better person. That should be the goal here for Mr. Thompson. I don't know that it, I don't think it is at this point. And I just don't know that it ever will be. On to today's armed citizen story from Jackson, Mississippi, where a home invasion turned into a self-defense shooting after the woman who lived inside shot and killed one of her attackers. And now the other suspect who survived has been charged with murder. 18-year-old Quintavian Miles, along with 15-year-old Caden Young, believed to be responsible for this home invasion. According to the Jackson police, the incident occurred Sunday morning about 2:30 in the morning when the two individuals wearing ski masks broke into an apartment at the Park at Inverness apartment complex. Investigators say that Quintavian Miles instructed Young to cover the doorbell camera while he used a screwdriver to pry the door open. But he couldn't get the door open with the screwdriver, so then they just broke the glass to get inside. A female resident inside the apartment grabbed a handgun, fired multiple rounds, according to Jackson police, and struck Caden Young. He tried to run away, fell to the ground before he could get out of the apartment, and was deceased there at the scene when the police arrived. The victim in this case, taken to police headquarters, later released. WAPT says authorities say the shooting might be justifiable under the state's castle doctrine law. Oh, I would think this is definitely justifiable under the state's castle doctrine law. Somebody's breaking into your home at 2:30 in the morning. They're not there to deliver Girl Scout cookies. They're not there to give you a Valentine's Day present. This woman had every right to protect herself. And I understand, again, there's a process here, right? The police have to investigate. They have to turn the results of that investigation over to a grand jury. It's up to the grand jury to say, no, we're not going to charge this woman with anything. And I expect that that's what the Hinds County grand jury is going to find here. In the meantime, Quintavian Miles being held without bond on a murder charge. We'll see if we can get any more updates from Jackson in the near future. And finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. I got deja vu when I saw this headline. You know, yesterday we talked about this individual who saved a pregnant woman after her car went into a pond in Florida. I don't know what's going on down there in the Sunshine State. We have a nearly identical story. This time, a Good Samaritan saving a mother and her three children after her car went into a canal in Florida. This was in Martin County, Florida. In fact, it was the second incident of its kind in Martin County since Friday. The other incident we talked about yesterday, I believe, also in Martin County. In this case, the Martin County Sheriff's Office believes that the mom suffered a seizure while she was driving. And so her car ended up flipping into a canal on Sunday. There was a Good Samaritan who saw what was going on, jumped into the water, was able to rescue the woman and her three kids from the submerged vehicle, which had actually flipped over at that point. District Fire Chief Joshua Schell called the Good Samaritan's actions heroic, but also said, you know, we want to make sure that people don't, in essence, create a second victim for us. So there are hazards such as alligators, sharp metal, and fuel spilling out of the car. There are a lot of hazards that go into these types of calls. And I get that. I do. But at the same time, but it's a lot to ask of somebody, right? You see this happen. You see this car go off the road, veer into a canal. Maybe you hear the cries for help. You're just supposed to say, well, I'm just going to sit here and be a good observer until law enforcement arrives. Call 911 and say, get here as quick as you can. A lot of people would do that. But, you know, I'm going to praise the guy who jumped into the water, despite the fuel that might have been spilling out, despite the sharp metal and broken glass that might have been present, despite the alligators that might have been lurking, to save that woman and her three kids. One other thing of note, apparently the youngest child's car seat was unbuckled, which in this case helped the Good Samaritan pull the kid out of the car a little bit easier, but at the same time, like, that kid could have been thrown out of the car entirely. Make sure that your, you know, kids are buckled in there. Chief Shell said, in this case, it did work, but I'd say just making sure car seats are installed properly, seatbelts are secured. Also recommended that every driver keep a seatbelt cutter and a window breaker inside their vehicle. I think that's good advice. I just, I don't know about telling, you know, any potential Good Samaritan just to sit back and wait until the authorities arrive. That's a hard thing for some folks to do. And in this case, had that Good Samaritan waited, we may very well have been talking about an entirely different outcome here. So in the right place, at the right time, we'll be able to do the right thing. The anonymous Good Samaritan in Martin County, Florida, we thank you for your very, very good deed. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to spending some time with Knox Williams tomorrow on the show talking about, I mean, I wish the topic were better. Last time we had Knox on, I think we were talking about the 0% tax on suppressors, right? The $200 transfer tax that's been zeroed out by the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. And Virginia Democrats hoping to more than double that $200 tax by imposing a new $500 tax on Virginians who are purchasing suppressors. Again, Knox going to be in Richmond testifying against that proposal this afternoon. We'll get his thoughts tomorrow, and we'll just share them with you on Wednesday's Bearing Arms Cam & Company. In the meantime, be sure to check out Bearing Arms throughout the day. We are keeping you up to date on the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation, including a bizarre story in Delaware, where a law that's been put on hold by a federal judge was actually prosecuted. In fact, police arrested somebody, prosecutor charged somebody, the court allowed it. It wasn't until months later that the State Department of Justice realized, oh, we're not actually allowed to prosecute that law. Now, we got that story and a lot more for you waiting at VarianArms.com. If you like what you see, I encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, VIP Platinum member. No matter what tier support you choose, you're going to be supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms. I greatly appreciate that. Use the promo code FIGHT and you can get 60% off your VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum membership. Have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. I'll be joining Carl Higbee on Newsmax in the 6 p.m. Eastern hour. Hopefully I'll see you there. And if not, I'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.